Dear friends, in Jesus Christ, one of the more blunt teachings of the Bible, and one that even many Christians often have a hard time accepting, is the teaching that we have a natural human tendency to hate God. We have a natural human tendency to hate God. I mean, that sounds a little over the top, doesn't it? Certainly most of us would acknowledge that we don't always love God as well as we could or as well as we should. But hate him? Isn't that a little bit of an exaggeration, a little bit of a hyperbole? I'm not angry at God. I'm not mad at him. I'm not opposed to him. I don't consider him my enemy. And yet the Bible is clear that in our natural sinful state, we are actively opposed to God. We resent his authority. We resent his control over our lives. And unless he's pouring out blessing after blessing after blessing in our lives, we would just assume that he keep his distance from us. Now this morning, I'm going to suggest to you that to the degree that one recognizes and acknowledges their own enmity and resentfulness towards God, then he or she will also have the power and the ability to love others with the same kind of love that God has for us. Let me say that again. To the degree that one recognizes and acknowledges their own resentfulness towards God, then he or she will also have the power and the ability to love others with the same kind of love that God has for us. In other words, once we recognize on a daily basis that we have standing before God solely by the grace of Jesus Christ and absolutely nothing else, that he willingly died for his enemies, you and me, then not only will we be able to love God and each other better, but we'll even be able to live out Jesus' command here in our text, this command to love your enemies. That's the heart of what we're going to study this morning. Now let's be honest. Of all the commands that Jesus gives to us, this one here in verse 27 has got to be the most difficult one to carry out. I mean, it's hard enough to love our friends well. We so often fail to love the people that we say we love as well as we should. Yeah, we're willing to help our friends, our family, up to a point. But even the very best of relationships have their limits. And so if it's sometimes hard to love our friends well, how in the world can we ever live out Jesus' call here in our text to also love our enemies? It's interesting to note that most of the major religions in the world share similar ethics. In other words, they're all agreed that it's not good to murder, it's not good to steal, it's not good to lie. We could come up with a whole list. They all promote various ideals such as compassion towards others, honesty in one's relationships, mercy towards those in need. But when it comes to this ethic of love even for one's enemies, that's a principle that's exclusive to Christianity. In other words, you're not going to find it in any other major religions in the world. It's that countercultural. It's that difficult. And apart from the work of the Spirit, humanly speaking, it's so unnatural. Love your enemies. Is such a thing even possible? It's in the Bible, and so I suspect none of us want to disrespect such a lofty view of love. But is it achievable? And if it is achievable, what in the world would that look like? I don't want your minds to begin to wander too far, and I'm a little hesitant to do this, but take a moment. Take a moment to think about someone who has personally hurt you immensely. In other words, an enemy. Maybe you wouldn't call them that, but it's fair to say you find it very difficult to love them because of the pain they've brought into your life. And if you're fortunate enough not to be able to identify anyone who has personally hurt you, then just think about the kind of person you yourself have a hard time loving. A convicted murderer, a child molester, someone who's deeply hurt someone you do love. What exactly would it look like to fulfill Jesus' command here in our passage? What would Christ-like love towards them entail? And how would you know if you're actually doing it? How would things be different than perhaps they are right now? Now, before we take a closer look at our passage, let me just make it very clear what Jesus is not saying here in this text. Because this is a text that often gets misinterpreted and misused. When someone mistreats us, Jesus is not saying, just let them walk all over you. He's not saying, just be a doormat whenever someone verbally, emotionally, or physically abuses you. That's not what Jesus means when he's talking about turning one's cheek. He's not saying, just take it whenever an injustice occurs. He's not saying, don't stop, don't intervene. Just let it happen. This isn't a call to pacifism when it comes to war. And of course, one of the reasons that we know this is because throughout Scripture, we observe the prophets denouncing injustice all the time. Woe to those who are greedy. Woe to those who mistreat others. Woe to those who abuse their power. Over and over again, that the Bible denounces injustice and calls Christians to have a heart of compassion for the poor and the oppressed. We're to act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with our God. In fact, Jesus even calls out his oppressors when he personally is mistreated. Did you remember when he was on trial before he went to the cross? During this trial, he's illegally struck on the face, and he doesn't hesitate to call it out. Later, the Apostle Paul does the same thing. He's put in jail without a trial, even though he's a Roman citizen. What does he do? He protests. He appeals to Caesar. He essentially says to his oppressors, you better think twice about what you're doing, or you're going to be in a heap of trouble. Okay, so it's clear that Jesus isn't calling us to be doormats. Turning one's cheek doesn't mean just let people walk all over you. It's not a call to remain idle when some form of abuse or oppression is taking place. Far from it. But then what is he teaching? What does he mean when he calls us to love those who hate us, to bless those who curse us, and turn our other cheek to those who strike us? Well, let's take a look at our text. The context is important. Earlier in the chapter, Jesus has just called 12 individuals to be his apostles. In other words, they're to be ambassadors who preach his gospel to the world. And no sooner does he call them, but he also warns them of what it will mean to follow him. He tells them that following him would most certainly mean poverty, hunger, sorrow, persecution. And yet, despite the suffering, they would also know his blessing of inner peace and joy. In contrast, those who don't follow him, those who instead just live for themselves, would for all intents and purposes appear to thrive. They would become wealthy, they would have power in this world, they would likely greatly abuse and persecute those who follow Jesus. And of course, when this happens, the natural human response is to hate one's oppressors, maybe even fight back a little. If not fight back, at the very least, try to stay away from them. Even the rabbis at the time agreed that God's people were certainly obliged to love their fellow Jews, but they weren't obligated to love their enemies, people such as those Romans who were blatantly oppressing God's chosen people. But now here comes Jesus, and he raises the stakes considerably. Not only does he call his followers to love their friends well, but he also calls them to love their enemies. And the word that he uses for love here isn't just a friendship kind of love, it's agape love. In other words, the kind of love one even shows to those who don't deserve it. Agape love is pure, willful, sacrificial love that intentionally desires the highest good for the one it's being directed towards. Pure, willful, sacrificial love that intentionally desires the highest good for the one it's being directed towards. And so whether it be that demeaning boss at your work, whether it be the scheming coworker, the angry neighbor, the hostile ex-spouse, or the former close friend, yes, this is the one who Jesus is calling us to love. Whoever our enemy might be, that's precisely who Jesus is calling you to love today. Okay, now we know who we are supposed to love. We also know what kind of love we're called to display. Now the million-dollar question. How in the world do we do it? How do we do it? So feel free to correct me afterwards if you think I'm wrong, but I suspect that when you and I are mistreated, we often respond in one of three different ways. Let me describe the three different ways human beings often respond to personal injustice. As I do so, reflect on what your natural response often is. We've touched on one already. Some of us respond quite passively. We hold our frustration, we hold our anger within, we try our best not to let it show publicly. We do our best not to let it get to us. We're really hesitant to confront the one who is mistreating us or others. We don't want to rock the boat. In fact, we often think it'd be more painful to confront and change than it would be to continue to take the mistreatment. It's one of the reasons abused people have an incredibly difficult time leaving their abusers. In the context of our text, it's keeping the same cheek in place so that the perpetrator can just keep hitting it over and over again. And that's how some people respond to injustice. They're passive. They don't want to rock the boat. And in doing so, the action is never challenged, it's never confronted, it's never addressed. And it's also not real community. It's not a healthy relationship. Real relationships involve honest truth-telling. The opposite, the second response, of course, is the person who, when mistreated, fights back. It's the eye for an eye, the tooth for a tooth. Whereas the passive individual is more like a turtle, the one who fights back is more like a skunk. Don't you dare threaten me, I'll spray you accordingly. The third kind of response, well, it's actually the worst. And it's the person who does both. We're mistreated, and initially, at least on the outside, we're quite passive. Inside, we're boiling. We're cooking a stew. And if that perceived injustice continues, the more it begins to boil. And unfortunately, sometimes that inner anger boils over. It explodes. It's a volcano. That's the passive-aggressive response. Unfortunately, it's often my own response. I suspect some of you fit in that category as well. Taken to the extreme, it's also the most dangerous. It's generally this kind of response that leads to mass shooting, serial killers, or this recent killer in Idaho who murdered four college students. Outwardly, they are, for the most part, blending right in with the rest of society. Inwardly, they're filled with rage. And ultimately, it all came tumbling out. So that's the natural human response when we're wronged, or when we think we're wronged. What is Jesus teaching? I'm going to suggest to you this morning is that the response Jesus teaches is one that's radically different from the world around us. It's a spirit-filled response full of concern for any kind of injustice, but very little concern for the need to maintain one's image, one's reputation, one's ego. Christians are not afraid to confront injustice. But they don't do so out of any kind of spite or malice. There's a non-anxious presence about them, no matter how cruel the injustice. And so whereas the natural human response might be to be passive on the outside, burning within, the Christian response is to be unafraid to oppose on the outside, but on the inside, filled with calmness and peace, because we know who ultimately is in control. We are filled with grace and love towards our oppressors because we know that we too are sinful human beings. We're not afraid to speak the truth. We're not afraid to call out the injustice, but we do so with such incredible, tender love towards the one who is oppressing. It's justice and kindness together. In other words, we don't leave our cheek there to keep getting slapped, but neither do we slap their cheek in return. We're called to turn our cheek. We'll get to that in just a bit. In the meantime, look at how Jesus instructs his disciples to love their enemies. Do good to those around you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Take note, agape love is not just something one feels, it's something they do. There's a progression here. To do good to those who hate is to love with our actions, doing good to those who do us wrong. To bless those who curse is to love with our speech, using gentle words of grace when people speak to us in anger. And to pray for those who mistreat you is to love with our hearts, asking God to rescue them from their sin. And taking together our actions, our words, our prayers are a powerful response to the hatred of our enemies. So do you want to feel convicted? Go back and think about that enemy of yours. Let's see how good you're doing at keeping Jesus' command here. What good actions have you done for them lately? What words of blessing have you spoken to him or her? What's been the tenor of your prayer that you've offered to God regarding them? I guarantee that if you are truly and genuinely praying to God for your enemy, you're not going to hate them for long. You're going to begin to see them the same way you hopefully see yourself, a needy sinner in need of God's tender mercy and grace. Now, in addition to loving our enemies with our words, with our actions, with our prayers, Jesus also famously tells us to turn our other cheek. And if they take our coat, we'll give them our shirts as well. What in the world? What in the world? Probably be helpful to know that in the ancient world, a slap on the cheek was really intended to be an insult, not an act of violence. It was an insult. And in the broader context of our text, certainly one of the things that turning the other cheek implies is that as Christians, we can expect to be insulted, humiliated, demeaned, generally because of our faith. Rather than retaliate and take revenge, Jesus calls us to endure such things with peace, with patience. But it also means something else. It means giving the oppressor the opportunity to start the relationship anew, to start over, and to begin a new way of relating to one another. So for example, when a spouse is verbally abused, and when they finally gain the courage to confront their spouse, their abuser, to no longer tolerate it, to put up strict boundaries, turning the other cheek is not an invitation for more verbal abuse. No, it's an invitation to start the relationship afresh. It's saying, I love you enough to confront you on your sin. Now let's start over. Let's begin this relationship again. Let's make it become what it should be. Now, up until this point, Jesus has mainly been talking about how to love those who attack our dignity, those who assault our image, our self-worth, maybe even our ego. But this reference to be willing to give up one's coat and tunic teaches us that we should be more concerned about the needs of other people than about the protection of our own property. In other words, Jesus is saying, if someone's desperate enough to steal your coat, then let them have some of your other clothing as well. Essentially, it's an attitude of being willing to sacrifice one's own comfort for the sake of others. And this self-sacrificial love not only applies to our own family, but also to those in community around us. We're called to give generously our time, our talents, our resources. As disciples of Jesus Christ, the question is not, if I give this, what's in it for me? What will I get in return? No, it's because of what Jesus has done for me. How can I best give generously to others? Which leads us to the golden rule found in verse 31. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Do to others as you would have them do to you. The rule most of us learned already in kindergarten as it applied to the playground during recess. It's a rule that we heard Mom and Dad remind us of when we were fighting with our siblings. It's a good rule to apply to most relationships in our life. Take note, the rule is not don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. No, it's a rule of love. It's a call to love. It's a call to treat others in the same way that you want them to treat you. And yes, even if you're fairly certain they're never going to do it. The very idea of actively loving our enemies takes us right to the heart of the gospel. Jesus goes on to make it clear that even most unbelievers love those who love them first. It's quid pro quo love. You love me, I'll love you. Agape love is different. Agape love is much more radical. It's not only love for our friends and those who like us, it's even love for our enemies. It's love for those who hate us, for those who curse us. And it's a love that's not limited. It's not based solely upon self-interest. It's the kind of love that flows from the love that we ourselves have received from God. All right. By now, hopefully we understand the kind of love that Jesus is calling us to have towards others, a radical, sacrificial love that extends even towards one's enemies. But now the even harder question, is this even remotely achievable? Is this even remotely achievable, or is Jesus just giving an impossible command? We again suggest that the place for us to begin to live such a life of love is to first recognize and acknowledge that we ourselves were once enemies of God. And yes, even today, we still have a natural tendency to act as God's enemy. Let me say the hard truth in love to you. If you don't think you've ever been an enemy of God, probably not a Christian. If you don't think you've ever been an enemy of God, probably not a Christian. Again, it's a biblical truth that's not always well received. Most people have a hard time accepting it. Most people will say, I'm not as religious as I should be, but I'm not an enemy of God. I'm not mad at him. I'm not angry at him. I'm not opposed to him. And yet a Christian is one who recognizes that they have a natural tendency to resent God's control over their life. Christians know that they often have an inclination to try and use God. That we have this foolish tendency to think that as long as we do good things, live a good moral life, worship God on a regular basis, he's going to bless our lives accordingly. And we often expect God to give us what we think we need. But when God's not blessing us, when life isn't going the way that we think it should, when he takes something valuable away from us, watch out. The blood begins to boil. We may not publicly show it. We're really good at hiding it. But we're seething inside. And believe it or not, that's the way a lot of people relate to God. And it's understandable. It's our human nature. You see, if you think some people have a hard time acknowledging just how angry that they get with other people, that they're not very self-aware, How easy do you think it is for them to acknowledge their inner anger with God? The true Christian is one who readily acknowledges their resentfulness, their inner anger towards God. And they also know that by the pure grace of God, we are accepted by Him solely through the death and the resurrection of Jesus, the one who even prays for his enemies as they're killing him on a cross. And so again, to the degree that you recognize your own enmity, resentfulness towards God, you'll also have the power and the ability to love others with the same kind of love that God has for you. Romans 5, verse 10, "For if when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life?" The very nature of God is to be good to the wicked and the ungrateful. And through the death and the resurrection of Jesus, we who were once his enemies are now adopted children of God. We're adopted enemies who belong to God's family. And if God can adopt and love us, then through the power of his Spirit, we too can begin to love our own enemies. We can live out the last part of our passage where Jesus says, "But love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting anything back. And then your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful." And through the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus, and through the power of the Holy Spirit, we can begin to love our own enemies in the same way that God loves each one of us. So let's go live it. Shall we? In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.